Hi there. Welcome to We Need to Talk, a weekly podcast that can help empower each of us. And I'm the host, Jane Hasler, a sociologist, mental health professional, and mother of eight, seven sons and one daughter, who range in age from 15 up to 32 years. Each episode, I'll be talking with an expert on a particular social issue, from bullying to climate change, from male violence to ethical behaviour. Knowledge is power, so let's get started. This week, I'm talking with investigative journalist Jess Hill on domestic abuse, in particular coercive control. Jess is the author of the superbly researched book, See What You Made Me Do, and presents the documentary series of the same name. She is also the host of The Trap, a podcast about love, abuse, and power. Jess is unrelenting in her quest to better understand and provide real solutions to the scourge of domestic abuse. Get ready for a vitally important discussion on an issue that affects so many of us, either directly or indirectly. Jess, thank you so much for your time. When do you ever get a break?
Never. I never get a break. I literally actually just came off an interview that I'm doing for this podcast series. So I'm still finishing off the last few episodes. This is a 10-part series. And then I'm going to write a quarterly essay on Me Too in Australia. So it's relentless.
Oh my God. Well, it's your own doing, isn't it?
I know. It's my problem. I say yes to too many things.
That's right. Well, I just wanted to ask you, I mean, you're an investigative journalist, and in 2014, you really focused on coercive control, domestic abuse. Was there a catalyst that made that be your primary focus at that time? Because you've covered a whole range of various issues.
Yeah, I'd say the catalyst really was the advocacy of Rosie Batty after the murder of her son, Luke, and the fact that Victoria, off the back of that, committed to a Royal Commission on Family Violence. And it became such a massive statewide issue. Now, I'm based in Sydney, I'm not based in Victoria, but The Monthly, the magazine that commissioned my first feature on domestic abuse, they are based in Melbourne. And for them, it was clear that this needed some really serious coverage. And, you know, at that time, when they commissioned me to write a 4,500-word feature on domestic abuse, that was really unusual. I mean, now, a few years on, that's not that remarkable. In fact, there's been a lot of long-form pieces on this subject. But back then, it was still something that was rarely written about. And so I started writing that coming from a position of really knowing nothing about the subject and deciding that I was going to do everything I could to try to understand it as best as I could, because it seemed clear that there was a gulf between community perceptions about this issue and the reality of it.
Well, can I just say your superb book, See What You Made Me Do, which I read when it first came out, boy, did it resonate with myself, because I've done a lot of research on gender, on identity, on male violence. And when the humiliated fury, and I'm going, I was reading your book and I'm going, yes, this is it, you know, and you did such a fantastic job with researching all of this area. So you are really an expert on it. You deserve the Stella Prize. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So then you made that your primary focus. It's surprising when you think about it that there hadn't been a lot of in-depth stuff on this.
I know. And I think that's what I think I wrote something about this in the introduction to the book, which was basically to say that there'd been so much focus on the threat of things like Islamic terrorism, where this gigantic crime wave had gone virtually unreported on, and that these were patterns, that this was not just about one-off incidents or one-off homicides, that these formed patterns of behavior in our communities that were widespread and prevalent and were absolutely, that it is one of the most corrosive elements at the heart of our society, shows itself in so many ways that are both direct, so the direct impacts on the lives of victim survivors, both adults and kids, and indirect in the rising level of homelessness, persistence of gender inequality. And really great thing that I've never forgotten, that the head of Scottish Women's Aid, Marcia Scott, said, is that violence against women is both a cause and a consequence of gender inequality. I can't see too many other feminist projects aside from, you know, projects to combat racism and others, but the moves to reduce or end men's violence against women is one of the most important feminist projects we have at this time, because if we don't do this, we will never get to anything close to gender equality.
Absolutely. It's so important, isn't it, to look at the cause, I mean, from a gendered perspective, that it is very much tied into gender expectations around masculinity, which can tip over into bullying and violence and also depression amongst a lot of males. I mean, these gender expectations can trap a lot of males too, can't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and just speaking from a perspective of having 7 sons myself and a daughter, you know, we've brought all of our sons up to be, we've walked our talk, my husband and myself. We've said, you don't need to stick to gender expectations around masculinity. You need to be yourself. But so many males feel the opposite. And it starts from a young age, doesn't it? Do you believe that education is a key focus, that we need to be implementing that in our schools from a young age?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to that question. I mean, first of all, I'd like to say, just because, you know, when we talk about domestic violence, we talk predominantly about men's violence against women, but of course there's violence in same-sex relationships, non-binary, there's violence from women towards other women in same-sex relationships. And so I tend to talk about it as, I don't use this term so often, but this is how I think about it, is patriarchal violence, not necessarily gendered violence. And that's not to invisibilize men's violence. And that's why often in my writing, I will use that binary, men's violence against women, when in fact the dynamics that I'm describing can encapsulate a whole range of relationships. But the patriarchal violence essentially comes back to the notion that we live in a society in patriarchy, in which the notion of having power over is valorized. Now, it is most obviously encouraged in men, but it is something that is valued across our society and at any cost.
Yes.
Is sort of the message. I mean, you only have to look as far as Canberra to see what the message around power over.
Absolutely. Yeah, power and control.
Exactly, yeah. Power and control. So you see these dynamics being replicated in various relationships and not just perpetrated by men. But I think if we look at what is patriarchy, essentially patriarchy is a system of male domination, of men's dominance over women, of white people's dominance over people of color, of people's domination over nature, you know, this hierarchy of control. But obviously when we're talking about how do we start to educate about this in schools, certainly really starting to address that most obvious and most the presenting factor of men's dominance over women is a very important component of that. And I think that there's certainly a lot to be said about encouraging respect in relationships and all of that sort of thing. But I think there's also a lot to be said when we talk about humiliated fury, particularly in men, is how to educate our young boys not to be afraid of rejection, not to feel defined by a girl rejecting them. And the tricky thing is that while we're trying to talk to them about how to be a different kind of man in this world, they are still living in the patriarchy that we're trying to change. And I think a lot of what we see in young guys is that from a really early age, they are shamed by their peers, by both boys and girls, to being a certain type of person, to being the idea of what a man is. And the more sort of callous and cold, you know, they can be, somehow that kind of makes, you know, that can really make boys popular, that can make them attractive, that can make, you know, there's a lot of rewards given to boys who exhibit that type of patriarchal masculinity. So, and there's not just rewards for that, there are consequences for boys who don't exhibit that kind of patriarchal masculinity, where they are seen to be an outsider, where they may be a threat to other boys because they might not go along with the sexist joke, or they might dob on boys for being inappropriate towards a girl who's drunk at a party. So, you know, there's this whole idea of the brotherhood as you're growing up, which is like, excuse the bad behavior, never betray your mates. And this is a particularly Australian version, you know, mateship in Australia is defined by masculinity, and it's defined as a brotherhood of silence. Never betray your mates, no matter what they do. So there's a lot on a national identity front. There's a lot on the idea of what patriarchy is and how it entraps boys and girls. There's so much to uncover and unravel. And in that, not pretending that we don't live in that world. You have to also equip these young boys and girls for the fact that we do still live in that world.
Absolutely. Australia is still a very gendered bastion, isn't it? Mm. I recently spoke at the National Conference on Bullying and spoke about how boys and girls can be bullied from a gendered perspective. And as you were just saying, that's the outcome of a lot of males. They will be picked on if they don't fit into this stereotype of being tough, hiding your emotions. And a lot of boys are fearful of even not bullying because then they think, oh, well, then I'm going to be looked on as a wuss or a weak. And then, exactly. And then I might be bullied myself.
Well, that's why, that's totally, you know, one of the things, you know, when we were talking about men's violence starts with disrespect towards women. And my feeling is really that men's violence actually starts with disrespect towards other men and the fact that they don't have the freedom to live in accordance with their hearts and their true beliefs. Mm-hmm. And as bell hooks says, you know, the first betrayal a man commits is against himself, or the first act of violence a man commits is against himself.
So do you think we need to be looking more at creativity, the individual strengths of each person, separate to expectations around what sex they are in the school system? I mean, you look at a whole lot of other school systems across the world, say the Scandinavian countries, a lot of them, who tend to focus on creativity. Do you think that'd be a good way to go here in our school system?
I mean, anything that, encourages independence and creates some permission around nonconformity, you know, which is not exactly what we see in our school systems, unfortunately. Yes. But also, you know, like I've seen recently, even in my daughter's playgroup in her preschool, she's four. Mm-hmm. And there was a bit of an issue with one of the boys there that was being a bit mean. There were some other issues where it was, and I was starting to think like, oh my gosh, you know, it's very early for us to be having these issues at age four. But there was a sense of like, it was verging on bullying, you know, and worse, my daughter and a few other girls seemed to be infatuated with this boy who was acting mean to them. And I was a bit at a loss as to what we could do. And in the end, the preschool took it upon themselves to have a group conversation about it and so that there was gentle accountability. You know, they're very young.
Yes, that's right. You can only say so much.
But it was really about like, we see this, we're not allowing it to continue. You don't just get a leave pass because you're a little boy, but we believe the best in you. We want to see you thrive, but we don't want to see that thriving at the expense of other girls who are starting to feel scared. So let's all have a conversation about it. And in the end, they agreed to all hit the reset button. And with some very careful supervision, you know, in the days that are following, they're able to reform this behavior. And that's the sort of thing we need to be doing. Like, I think back to my childhood, and at this age, I'm sure all that stuff was going on, but it was just seen as, well, suck it up. You know, that's the rough and tumble of childhood. And then that's the rough and tumble of being a teenager. And then it's of being an adult. And it's actually like, you know what, does it have to be? Because actually that's just engendering bad behavior. And the best thing you can do for a little boy who's maybe starting to get a sense of their power and throw it around is to make that visible, to confront them on it and to show them that there's another way for them to be. They don't need to be like that. And it needs to happen young, because if you let that behavior go to the point where that kid's 7, 8, 10, 12, 15, they just learn that the way they get what they want and the way they get their needs met is to throw their orb around, and they start to feel entitled to it.
Yes, totally seen it with my own experience with my own kids, and having to intervene when I've gone to the school and said, guys, how would you like it? One of my sons came home and said, I'm being bullied. He was only about 8, started a new school. And I said, which is the bully? He pointed. We're at a sports carnival. And I went up and I said, I've heard that you haven't been very nice to my son. And why is that? Oh, because he's new. He's different. And I said, but that's a good thing. How would you feel if that happened? And he said, I'd feel terrible. And I said, well, don't do it again. Otherwise, I'll tell the principal, etc. Anyway, the next day, my son came home and he said, he's my best friend now. And you have to call it out, don't you? You have to call it out.
Yeah. And not be afraid to call it out. Not to be, you know, I think too often at that young age and, you know, leading up into teenage years, it's that feeling of like, oh, what will happen if it turn up? Will it make it worse? Most times it won't. Most times it's actually, once it's visible, most bullies, you know, and not all, but most are not like super committed, you know, but if they get away with it, they just continue the behavior. And I think that so much of what you see in coercive control and domestic abuse later, or even in teenage years, early 20s, is this feeling of how dare you challenge me? How dare you not go along with exactly what I'm asking? And, you know, what did you just mutter under your breath? It's very much a replication of the schoolyard bully, but in an intimate relationship. And it's harder both to see it in an intimate relationship and to confront it, because it's only happening often between the two of you. So confronting that type of bullying in school, where it's happening much more in public sight, is really fundamental if we're going to get any headway on this. I think bullying's a big piece of it.
Totally. It's arresting that slide, isn't it? In a way, at when you can nip it in the bud and you can get them to think about it, because this idea still is around that people say, oh, well, the kids just have to go through that, the bullying and being bullied. That'll toughen them up, which is ridiculous, because
it's the opposite. It doesn't toughen them up. It makes them more vulnerable. And not to mention, you know, you'll get a lot of perpetrators later who have been bullied themselves as kids and who feel like they were never in control. And then once they get to be an adult, they're like, well, I'll never be out of control again and I'll be the one bullying, you know.
Yes.
It's that saying, hurt people hurt people. And, it, you know, my partner is a therapist. He deals with the ongoing effects of bullying every day with his clients. It's such a scourge. And it just, you know, it is labor intensive for schools, but it's a lot better than having to deal with the outcome of letting it go.
Totally. When I worked in mental health as a mental health registered nurse, so many of the clients had been bullied in high school and in primary, and they had, and even in their workplace, it hadn't been addressed correctly or nipped in the bud, and they felt so alone, and here they were ending up with chronic mental health issues.
Exactly.
Look, I wanted to ask you, now I read at the beginning of your book, you were going to call it domestic violence, so you swapped over to domestic abuse. You had to change, go through the whole book and put in domestic abuse rather than domestic violence. And why was that, Jess?
Yeah, well, it was triggered by an article that I read by an amazing woman, Yasmin Khan, who works with predominantly South Asian women in Brisbane, particularly migrants. And a lot of these women would come to her and say, well, it's not domestic violence because he never hit me. And they would describe the worst that might have happened would be a cup of tea in the face or, you know, intermittent small assaults. But then when she dig a little deeper, what they were subjecting them to in terms of control was just horrific. And she went on a Winston Churchill fellowship and went to the UK and other countries and found that in the UK particularly, they were calling it domestic abuse, because domestic violence, no matter how much we try to redefine it to encapsulate different types of non-physical forms of abuse, it still for people brings up the idea of a physical incident. And I just decided not to speak for, I'm not speaking for anyone else or speaking for the sector as a whole, but for me, I had to properly address the people who were reading my book or, you know, or just the people who were in my book who had not experienced physical acts of violence. And the only way I thought I could encapsulate their experiences was to call it domestic abuse. You know, there are other terms. Intimate terrorism is another term that particularly relates to coercive control. But in my book, I also do talk about types of abuse that are not coercive control, you know, that are a bit more reactive, not a systematic campaign of domination and power over. So that's the term that I ended up going with. And it's resonated really strongly with people. It's opened, I think, to start the book with that note, it started people thinking, okay, I'm going to think about this slightly differently. And that's just like opening their minds to having a totally different approach to it.
Yes, it's not just about the physical abuse. It's about a whole range of others. And so coercive control, can you give us some examples, the primary examples of coercive control?
Yeah, sure. And this looks different depending on what kind of relationship you're in, and it will take on all different forms. But essentially, coercive controllers, they seek to dominate and overpower their partners by isolating them in some way, by micromanaging them, creating an environment of threat, degrading them, alternating punishments with rewards. So sort of keeping a sense that, like, if the victim does what the perpetrator is asking them to do, that they will be able to micromanage and belittle and intimidate their partners. I think the whole purpose of coercive control is to override the victim's autonomy, mm-hmm. and to basically get them to the point where they start to forget who they are. And there's a term that really describes this. Lisa Aronson Fontes, who's an American psychologist, she uses the term perspecticide, which is that through the micromanagement of everyday activities, through these little degrading comments, through this sense that the victim survivor gets that they must see the world through the perpetrator's eyes because they need to be able to predict their demand before their next demand before they make it, the victim survivor starts to evacuate her sense of self or their sense of self, and in their place becomes the perpetrator's perspective, to the point where you reach a point where you're looking in the mirror or you're waking up in the morning and the first thing you see or hear is the perpetrator.
Yes.
You know, and you don't even hear yourself in your own mind anymore. And you're constantly thinking about their needs, their wants. You know, I just got off the phone with someone saying that the day that their perpetrator was arrested, the first thing that occurred to them was that they should call the perpetrator's best friend to go down to the police station to make sure he was okay.
Oh, wow.
You know, that's the sort of, you know, and she says, I don't recognize that person anymore. I mean, that's, and that person is not crazy. That person's not deluded. That person is caring for the perpetrator above and beyond themselves. And that is part of coercive control, is to basically override you to the point where the perpetrator's needs and wants are more important than your own. And in fact, yours start to disappear entirely.
Yes, it's almost like so many women have this massive sense of loss of identity, and they've almost forgotten the difference between what's right and wrong. And thinking about themselves and putting themselves first, because the old saying, you know, you hear something often enough, you start to believe it.
Mm. And there's nothing that you can, like, there's no way for you to be right. You know, there's no way for you to do the correct thing, because the point is not just that perpetrators micromanage their victims. It's that they set rules that change on a whim. And, you know that somehow what you're doing will be used against you. So it could be that you're taking your kid to the doctor because they've got an upset stomach. Now, you take your kid to the doctor and then your partner says you got Munchausen's by proxy and you're just pretending that your kid's got they've got a stomach ache because it helps you to think that they're a victim.
Oh.
Or you don't take your kid to the doctor and they accuse you of neglecting your child. It's like there is no way to win. The whole feeling of coercive control is I am in a no-win situation. All I can do is just try to hold on hour to hour, day to day, and try to survive this. And in that, when you're in that position, you're going to the survival part of your brain, that cognitive part of your brain, that, you know, really clear strategic part of your brain is very much handicapped if it's able to activate at all. And you are in pure survival, you know, in the back of your brain, just trying to react.
How exhausting.
Very exhausting. And not to mention, you are literally being exhausted by your partner. So many, you know, victim survivors will say they'd be woken up at 3 a.m. and made to answer to, you know, perceptions of infidelity, or they would be gaslighted to the point where they just felt like they were going insane. And the anxiety is exhausting alone, without having your sleep interrupted, without being made to feel like you're going insane. It's an impossible scenario.
Impossible. Caught between a rock and a hard place continually, being hypervigilant always. I mean, that is just so exhausting. So just wanting to talk a bit, Jess, about, at the moment, we've had the national plan to reduce violence against women and their children, started in 2010, due for the outcomes in 2022. And there were, very interestingly, there are three areas, and prevention really does need to be a primary focus. So the strategies at the primary, secondary, and tertiary areas. Now, primary, that's trying to change the culture, which is so important. But we're seeing that there's a lack in the secondary, and certainly at the tertiary areas, where women are so at risk of murder, homicide. I mean, we look at what happened with Hannah Clark, just using her as a tragic example. At the time that happened, my husband and I, with our kids, were living in Brisbane. We're now in Sydney. But my husband rang me from work and said, "Have you heard what's happened?" And it was in the suburb next to us that it happened. They were in Camp Hill, we were in Cooperoo, close to the city. And then when it came out what really happened, being a sociologist, I thought, my God, you know, we need to understand. I went up the next day with some flowers and a card. I had to do something. And I was interviewed by ABC Radio. And I said, look, we need to be looking at all the causes. People were coming out saying he's a monster, etc. But that's not really understanding the whole situation that occurred there, in the sense of we need to be looking at all the factors that led to that so that we can prevent it. But in my mind, and I did ring the police commissioner and spoke to the a couple of detectives in there, and I said, you know, Hannah and her kids were in such a vulnerable, at-risk position, being with living with her parents. They should have been in a place where he, Rowan Baxter, didn't know they were there, because it's such a high risk at the time of separation. And there's nothing more dangerous than a homicidal, suicidal person. Do you believe that this, what we need to do? I said, look, we needed to have her in a safe place where he wouldn't know where they were. We needed to be doing surveillance on him, have a bracelet. I mean, Hannah was fearful for her life. And just most recently, Kelly Wilkinson was fearful for her life. And look what tragically happened to her. She was set alight. And so many others. Tara Brown in 2015. So what are your answers there? What do we need to be focusing on to help prevent these homicides and familicides?
Well, the fact is, I think that we know what type of escalating behaviours lead to homicide. And in fact, Jane Monckton Smith, a UK forensic criminologist, has made the 8-stage homicide timeline. And it's not to say that in every case where those 8 stages are followed that homicide will be the outcome, but it becomes extremely high risk at that point. And, you know, the most telling aspect of those stages is the escalation of control, where physical violence, incidents of violence themselves are not the biggest telltale sign of an upcoming homicide, but the escalation of control is. And so what we do from there is really up for debate. But in terms of what kind of authority is made aware of these escalating patterns, at the moment, it's police, really, and some, you know, domestic violence crisis centres. Sometimes the family violence helplines are the ones who have the most information on that. Sometimes it's the police. Sometimes it's GPs, depends on who the victim survivor has disclosed to. But there needs to be some way in which to prevent the perpetrator at that point from following through with homicide. And at the moment, actually, our default position is to hide women and children. The default is to put them into a type of protective hiding and custody, which is otherwise known as a refuge.
Yes.
Whose addresses are kept secret, and in a lot of cases, the women and kids are moved across the state. They can't tell their friends or family where they are. You know, it is a type of protective hiding, but the consequences for women and children being uprooted from their homes and being put into hiding are gigantic, including massive financial consequences and sometimes a real pathway into poverty.
Yes.
And living in their cars. And, you know, I know so many women who've ended up doing that for years afterwards. So some of the sort of things that are talked about overseas and done a little bit here is, do we take these men out of the situation and put them into some sort of residential care where it's not necessarily prison, and, you know, charges or whatever might follow or might not, but putting them into some type of thing where they are monitored and where they do not have free access.
Yes.
And yes, some people have talked about possibly having bracelets, electronic monitoring. You know, I don't have a position on what we do there. My position is that we need to put a lot more attention on making sure that these men are not given a free rein.
Yes, and these women and kids are kept safe at that particularly vulnerable time.
Exactly.
And talking about criminalising coercive control, where are we up to with that, Jess?
So at the moment, Queensland and New South Wales are the two states who are most advanced in their discussions about it. In New South Wales, there was an inquiry that ran over several months, and the panel of members of all parties, they unanimously came to the conclusion that it should be criminalised. And when we say criminalised, what we really mean is that reforming the old laws.
Yes.
So reforming the old incident-based laws where police will turn up at a call out and ask what just happened. And by what just happened, they mean what happened in the past few hours, not what happened in the past few months.
Mm.
We just want to know what's happened to instigate this call out. And then we will make a decision based on that. Now, the problem is with that law, so many problems with it. A, you can't assess the risk based on the incident alone. B, you have women using violent resistance and self-defense who are being arrested and charged because they have committed an incident of assault, but it's not being looked at in the context of them being victims of coercive control. So there are so many problems with the current charge as it is, and what the campaign to criminalize coercive control doesn't come from the idea that by criminalising coercive control, we'll have fixed everything. And it doesn't even come at the idea of we just need new criminal statutes and that's what's going to address domestic violence. It says we've got a major problem with this part of the law. Let's just fix this.
Mm-hmm.
Let's also use that as a way to change culture, because like it or not, laws do indicate what we are or are not willing to accept as a society. Now, the way we enforce those laws has a big part to do with that as well, as we know in the case of rape yes. and marital rape. But when we say definitively that this is domestic abuse, it is against the law, it sends a message about the seriousness of coercive control. At the moment, when we have only physical, you know, maybe stalking, but very rarely, you know, is that prosecuted in relationships. But when we have this incident-based system, it gives a framework not just to the community, but to everybody, the whole constellation of services around police, that the incident is the most important thing. Physical violence is at the top of the harm pyramid, and nothing will change that, unfortunately, aside from changing the law. I've wrestled with this for months and months. I have like really read across abolitionist literature, you know, is police and the courts even the right way to come at domestic violence? And it is so clear that none of this is perfect, but we don't as it stands right now, have an alternative that will protect women and children? Is the criminal system a reliable protection for women and children? No, it's not. Should all these men go to jail? No, and they won't. That's, you know, the thing is, even if coercive control is criminalised, domestic violence by and large is dealt with as a civil issue in Australia, firstly, and becomes a criminal issue if there's a breach.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is to just draw a line, a red line under this behaviour, and say that if you commit it, you are at risk of being charged.
Yes, and sending that message out there into the community.
Yeah, and for a number of men, that will be a deterrent.
Yeah.
You know, I can't tell you how many women have said, when I called police and I got the courts involved, whether or not they handled it well, he suddenly saw that this was no longer between us and he backed off,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then there are guys who nothing will make them back off, and they literally do need to be put somewhere where someone can watch them. You know, that's just the reality.
Absolutely.
Of it.
And then in the secondary strategy, we talked about primary, secondary and tertiary. So arrest that slide, as I mentioned before, where it actually escalates to say to the guys, the fellas, you need to attend a course and to look at how to prevent your reactions, how to modify your reactions, how to understand where this is coming from. Because often a lot of them have been abused when they were younger. And so they need to really have that reflection. What do you think about that?
Well, look, I think that men's behaviour change programs, you know, they've got a mixed reputation. I think certainly they can help some people, no doubt. You know, probably need a little bit longer than 12 to 20 weeks, which is the average amount of, you know, duration. So look, I think that they definitely have a place. For me, I feel like the only thing that is really going to shift the dial on domestic abuse is community ownership of this situation. And the thing that I push the hardest is justice reinvestment, which is basically the way that it's worked in Australia, is to say that we are going to try to look at this as a community, as a whole. What can we do to help this family, to help the victim, survivor, the children, even to help the perpetrator to stop from being abusive, if that is possible? Try to get in there early before it gets to the level where there might need to be criminal justice system involved. But essentially having a mode of communication between everyone who's responding to this issue, having them casework what's happening in their own community and workshop how to best to respond in a way that puts protection at the heart of it and really tries, if it is at all possible, to look at whether this person who's committing this violence or oppression can be brought back into the community, can be a functioning member of the community again.
Yes, it's not like a continual punishment. It's a let's learn the opposite way of doing things and to actually have them be, as you said, a functioning person that has a full life and can change. I mean, a lot of people think they can never change.
Yeah.
But a lot can.
Yeah. And look, you know, there are some really high-grade narcissists, especially people with like psychopathy or sociopathy, that we're very much unaware of how to change these men. They don't do well in men's behaviour change programs. They take over and they make life difficult for the other men in the program. And a lot of men's behavior change programs just won't even have them,
mm-hmm.
you know. So this is the tricky thing is we need systems in place that can deal with those people. And while we try to figure out, is there a way for these people to access some kind of behavioral change or redemption, we need to have somewhere to put them so that they're not a threat to the community and threat to future victims. But I think the thing with justice reinvestment is that because, I mean, in Australia, the way that it's worked in places like Bourke.
Oh, which is fantastic how you describe it in the book. Isn't that amazing? It went from one of the highest, I think, domestic violence and homicide rates to now the lowest. Is that right in Australia?
Well, it's not so much the lowest. It's more that they had an enormous amount of crime in the area, such that they were, you know, tagged by the Sydney Morning Herald as the most dangerous town in the world, which of course is not true. On paper, it looked bad. You know, and there was certainly there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of crime being committed in that area. And what they did with Justice Reinvestment is to go, okay, we are going to look at the entire cohesion of the community, which includes domestic violence. It also includes these other non-violent offences, which are funneling our young people into juvenile detention. But as a community, they decided we need to know what's happening. So they accessed this data platform, which has been designed for communities to basically collect their own data. And they got a sense through collecting this data of what was going on, at what times of the day or night, you know, so they could then sort of structure their services to respond adequately instead of having, you know, services for young people operating 9 to 5 when the vast majority of youth crime was happening at 10 o'clock at night. So they got to understand that, and then they decided we're going to put circuit breakers in to try to interrupt how these crimes are getting going, particularly young boys going into juvenile detention, because once they're in juvenile detention, we know that they are most likely to keep returning and they're going to be at much higher risk for committing domestic violence, you know. So for Burke, that was the pathway. You know, for every different town, it will look different. But and then also just having this community cohesion around it. Not everyone in Burke agrees with the direction and the strategy, but they have basic agreement from the 26 or 27 different language groups, so that there is some sort of like streamlined approach.
And yes, I love the example. I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah. I love the example of the boys who there was a lot of crime around stealing cars, driving without a license.
Yeah.
What was happening was they didn't have people to teach them how to drive.
Precisely. It's just crime purely out of disadvantage, you know, and the fact that they didn't have people to teach them how to drive, enough registered drivers in the community to handle that. And so the Maranooka hub, which was where the Justice Reinvestment was located, they raised money to buy a car, paid someone to teach them, and then a whole bunch of off-duty cops volunteered to help teach them to drive. And, you know,
fantastic.
For better or worse, Burke is a town with a lot of cops. They are the central hub for a gigantic area in that outback New South Wales region. There are 40-something cops there stationed, you know, and they're everywhere. Now, do we want that, you know, ongoing? No, of course not. But for the meantime, that community needed to work with police to get them on board with this more protective approach, so that the police weren't acting at cross purposes with the community, and so that it wasn't just a punitive approach coming in over this protective approach. And luckily, the superintendent in that area, Greg Moore, was already of that ilk, you know, and he absolutely saw the success of Maranooka and what they were doing, and started this whole, you know, sort of secondary strategy called Operation Solidarity, and really re-educated the police again and again, because it's high turnover, it's a remote town, to approach this in a different way. So when they'd go out to repeat callers, you know, one house, police were being called every other day. And they went out repeatedly with someone who was really respected in community, who was able to talk to this guy who'd become a bit of an alcoholic and was very violent. And basically to say, look, we know this has flown under the radar for a long time, but it's not on anymore. And we can see what's happening. Now, how do we help you get through this? And eventually this man agreed to go to a men's group, and they go out on country together. They talk. And after going through these, you know, going through these steps, actually starting to talk about his trauma history, they got to a point where police were not being called out anymore.
Wow. Wow, that's fantastic.
And I've spoken to a number of police. Now Greg's moved on to another area, and so there are other police in charge there, and they still have that same approach. Now, whether or not you can replicate that in every area, you know, there's police and there's police.
Yes, I was going to say, though, it's fantastic. They work. You can see so many things that work from these programs, and you wonder, yeah, well, why aren't they being replicated elsewhere in Australia, or even just parts of them, which, for instance, you've probably heard the 39 tick boxes now in Victoria, where a woman can go into a police station and they're ticking it off. And if a certain number is met, then they go, whoa, this is a red flag. We need to do something here. This woman's in danger. And apparently the domestic violence occurrence has gone down significantly because of the action that's taken from this. And you sort of think, well, if Victoria can do it and it's great, why isn't this being rolled out in all the states and the two territories? Does that frustrate you when you see those sort of things?
Yeah, and I guess the problem is, you know, the states and territories. I mean, there's lots of good things to be said about having a federation of states and territories, yep. But also every single one needs to, you know, kind of reinvent the wheel. So even though we've got this national plan, there's a lot of stuff that happens on that state level. You know, interestingly, federal Labor has actually committed to rolling out 40 justice reinvestment sites.
Wow, fantastic.
If they're elected.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, I guess that, you know, it's... What I think is really important is that we don't get too carried away with long-term objectives such that we don't focus in on what's happening right now and preventing just the generational transmission even of violence from one generation to the next because we haven't intervened with families that are experiencing violence now. We have a basic approach that by increasing gender equality, we will decrease family violence. I don't think anyone would argue, well, maybe there's a few people who would, but generally speaking, we wouldn't argue with the idea that increased gender equality is a good thing, that it will have absolutely positive impacts for victim survivors. But I think that there's no real proof that increases in gender equality worldwide have led to decreases in domestic and family violence. So that's where we're at the moment.
And finally, Jess, with all of this that you're doing on such an important topic and such an important area, and I wanted to mention The Trap, your podcast, which I listened to the first two episodes, riveting and so important, Jess.
Thank you.
It really is fantastic. How do you stay sane with this? What do you do for your downtime? Because you are doing so much. And it is such a heavy topic. It's such an important topic. How do you look after yourself and have that balance?
Yeah, I think that anyone working in this sort of full time is it is really hard to maintain your access to joy.
Yes, I can understand.
I mean, anyone's had that with COVID. So, yeah, like, it's a good time to be really focusing in on this.
Yeah.
But, you know, my downtime is spent mostly with my four-year-old and my partner.
Yeah.
And there is something about that real simple interaction which is really joyful, you know.
Yes.
She's a really joyful kid when she's not being a little shit, you know.
I heard the other day what her first word was cockroach, was it?
Yes.
I can't understand her calling her dad cockroach.
That's right. Terrible, isn't it?
Normally it's daddy. Yeah. Or mummy, yeah. Or normally daddy, yeah, but the mum's there most of the time sometimes.
Well, too many living in the eastern suburbs and seeing too many cockroaches on the floor. But so there's that, and recently I've become a lot better at really looking after myself, mm-hmm. So going to therapy every week.
Great.
You know, and just trying to create space around this work. I think at the end of doing this podcast series, I will take a break from this subject material.
Mm-hmm. You deserve a break.
It's been a long time. Like I sort of feel like it's coming to the end of a 7-year cycle. You know, created a book, we've created a television series, we're now creating a podcast series. I will never totally pull out of it. I'll always be, you know, speaking about this. I'll always be writing about it to some degree. But I think having it being the only thing I work on, that's not really sustainable for me because I don't have an organization behind me. I'm just one person that kind of bounces around from one place to the next.
Oh, wow. I don't know how you've done all you've done. You're amazing.
But part of it, I want to keep on this because, as I said, you know, it is one of the most important feminist projects. The victim survivors still need so much in the way of advocacy and change. And even though my primary position in this has been as a journalist, once you know what you know, it's very hard to stay completely on one side of the journalist fence and not err onto the side of advocacy.
Absolutely.
And yeah. I definitely have erred onto that side.
Well, thank God you have, for the well-being of so many.
Yeah, I just couldn't sort of say what I had to say and then step away. I felt that was a bit unconscionable. So anyway, but yeah, that's where I feel like I'm I'm heading to is a break.
I'm glad to hear that. Jess, you so deserve it. The 7-year itch, so to speak.
Exactly.
You deserve a big change. I was just stunned by the research for your book. It was just amazing and it has helped so many. So thank you for all of your advocacy work. Thank you for your time today. And I'm sure passionate people, as we are, will cross paths down the track.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jane.
Okay, take care. If this episode has raised any issues for you, please call 1800 RESPECT or 1800 737 732. Next week on We Need to Talk, I'm discussing climate change with Professor Tim Flannery, a world leader on this critical global issue. Tim believes that climate change needs to be addressed as an emergency, and as such, urgent action has to be taken in Australia and internationally. It's both a sobering and inspirational discussion. I hope you'll join us. Until then, stay safe and remember, knowledge is power.